The UN Conference on Climate Change is expected to produce a landmark agreement. This hour, how that climate change agreement may change agriculture here in the Midwest. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also on the program, what the new renewable fuel standard level means for ethanol production, a conversation with the first African-American mayor of Waterloo, a study with good news for the treatment of advanced breast cancer, and we'll hear about Vincent the Cat in Ames, a feline just fitted with an exceptional set of prosthetic limbs. Buckle up for those stories and more. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few moments, how climate change talks in Paris could change agriculture here in Iowa. Also, later in the program, great news in a new study concerning the treatment of advanced breast cancer, some research at the University of Iowa. And toward the end of the program, we'll hear about Vincent, a cat in Ames, a feline just fitted with an exceptional set of prosthetic limbs. But first, the city of Waterloo has elected its first African-American mayor. His name is Quentin Hart. The 44-year-old defeated former Mayor Tim Hurley by a wide margin in Tuesday's mayoral runoff election. He joins us now on the phone. Mayor Quentin Hart, congratulations.
Thank you very much, Ben, and thank you for this opportunity to speak on IPR. Such a huge fan. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that comment. I understand you were crossing a bridge over the Cedar River in Waterloo when the final election results showed you winning. What was that moment like?
I mean, I can't. It's hard to explain. It still hasn't set in yet. But the river, the Cedar River in our community, has been seen for many years to be a dividing line. So I like standing in the middle of the bridge because I wanted to be the candidate that could bridge both sides of our community. And it also represents transition from getting from one side to the other as well. So it was fabulous. Great.
So a dividing line, the river, a dividing line between what and what?
Well, you know, it's always, it had been perceived as resources versus lack of resources. Even when you read the information that we have alongside of the bridge, the historic information, it talks about somewhat of like a mental divide. But, you know, the good part about this, yes, I am an African-American mayor, but, you know, and I'm proud of that. But I also want to be the best mayor. I want to be the type of person that could be progressive, that can be the people's candidate, be the people's choice, but also that can make sure that regardless of where you live at in the city, regardless of your economic status, that you have an opportunity and a voice when it comes to the direction that this city takes.
Mayor Hart, tell us about your goals in office. What do you want to accomplish here first off the bat?
Well, it's budget season. So the first couple months will be strictly dealing with the budget to make sure that we put a pretty good budget out there to our community. I'd like to redo and start doing a State of the Union, which I hope IPR could be at as well, to let the community know where we're headed. I need to meet with department heads. I need to meet with staff and meet with the council to figure out how they believe that they can best be utilized to serve the public as well. So, I mean, we're starting off on a whirlwind, trying to get things moving here. So we're not going to lose a beat at all. Mm-hmm. I campaigned on 5 points, safer streets, working to deal with some of the challenges we're having, you know, economic development so that we could continue to move our business community ahead. Neighborhood empowerment, because our associations are powerful vehicles for change, positive media campaign, and last but not least, a 2025 vision for the future of this city.
2025 vision, what does that mean?
That means we had our 2010, we had our riverfront renaissance, and I don't know when the last time you've seen our downtown area, our river, the youth pavilion, our Sullivan Memorial Museum. But now we need to transition, bring those collective voices back to develop a plan for the future? What do we want to look like in the year 2025? You know, how do we see ourselves? What are some projects that we can come together on and move this city forward? Just some group think and just great ideas from multiple people throughout this community as our vision for the future.
What's your city's Waterloo's chief economic challenge these days?
Our chief economic challenge these days, the getting over the perception sometimes that we may not be a great place to actually have businesses, you know, just from conversations and other things. And that's why we want to make sure that we showcase the best of what our community has to offer. You know, sometimes it seems that the 1% or 2% that may not be doing everything they can to make Waterloo a great place seems to receive 75% of the media communication. Now, don't quote me on that fact, but that's what it seems like. But Waterloo is a great place with hardworking people, a rich cultural diversity, many amenities and quality of life, educated community, hardworking people. And that's who we are. We are Waterloo. And that is the message that we need to get out. We are ready and we are open and we just embrace our business community. And that's the message that needs to be heard, because that's the real message of who we are.
I believe also Waterloo has the largest percentage of African Americans in the state of Iowa, something like 16%.
Yep.
Do you get the sense that African Americans, you're also African American, have different concerns than whites or other minorities in the city?
Well, yeah, of course. But you know, when we cut through, because I've, like I said, trying to be the mayor for the entire city, I've had the opportunity to live on the northeast side, which is heavily concentrated with minorities, not minorities, but a high percentage. I'm working on the south side of town when there's, you know, the casino and, you know, the college square, not the college square, but the malls and the shops. So I've had an opportunity to live and have a foot in every part of this community. And people want the same thing. They want quality of life. They want to be respected. They want to be heard. And so, yes, there's some very, very concerns that we need to deal with, you know, especially economic development in some of the parts of the community. But everybody wants the same thing. They want an opportunity to be heard. They want an opportunity to be respected. And they want an opportunity to have a good job, to take care of their families and have a good education.
Mayor Hart, I wonder, you grew up in Waterloo?
Yes, sir, I did.
I wonder what it would have been, what it would have meant to you to, as a young man, have encountered an African-American mayor. You were the first one in Waterloo.
It would have meant so much. You think about 1965, 50 years ago was the Voting Rights Act. And there are so many people that have come before me that have sacrificed so much for me to have the opportunities I have today. So just seeing that sacrifice, that commitment, and that's why the first thing I did on that next day after interview was walk to the school with my sons and gave hi-fi to all the young people at the school.
Hmm. Waterloo Mayor Quentin Hart, the new mayor of Waterloo, and I guess maybe I'm being a little bit too forward-thinking. You don't actually take office until when?
January 4th, but being on council for 7.5 years, I'm at my headquarters now working.
Okay, it sounds like you have a head of steam and are ready to go. So we'll let you get to it. Waterloo's new mayor, Quentin Hart. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. By the way, this morning we did a bit of fundraising on air. We want to let you know, perhaps you were helping us out to make our challenge $15,000 by 9 o'clock this morning. We did, in fact, make that challenge with donations of more than $15,000. So we will receive an additional $5,000 from Dr. Richard Deming. Thank you to all of you who contributed, and there will be opportunities for the rest of you who didn't get in on that challenge in the coming days. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. After years of faltering negotiations, the UN, the United Nations Conference on Climate Change, is expected to produce a landmark agreement that in the coming days, but it remains to be seen whether the gathering of I guess, 150 world leaders or so near Paris will achieve the target of limiting rising global temperatures. Joining me now to talk about how climate change talks in Paris could change agriculture here in Iowa and the Midwest. Amy Mayer is with us, IPR and Harvest Public Media reporter. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Ben.
So tell us, these talks going on the other side of the world, what could it mean for our agriculture?
There are a lot of ways that Iowa farmers and Midwest agriculture could help contribute to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, which is one of the main priorities for these talks. For example, when ground is plowed up and left barren over the winter, we lose an opportunity to keep carbon in the soil versus allowing carbon to be emitted into the atmosphere. So that's called carbon sequestration. And if there's more cover crops on the ground, for example, that's one way that we can help keep the carbon in the ground. Also, there are opportunities for farmers with both wind and solar electricity production to use some of their land for some different ways of generating power so we can rely less on traditional coal and natural gas sources.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Who have you spoken with about the various aspects of the impact of any climate change moves here in the Midwest?
Well, one of the interesting people I spoke with was University of Iowa engineering professor Jerry Schnorr. He has actually been on assignment, I guess you could say, in Switzerland, living in Zurich, but he's at the Paris climate talks and he is going to be writing about them for an engineering trade publication. But he was definitely well informed going into them. He's paying attention while he's there and he'll be trying to bring back some of the messages when he returns to Iowa.
Okay, I think we're going to hear a little bit of this. Is University of Iowa environmental engineer Jerry Schnorr.
All the pledges taken together that have been filed in advance of this meeting still do not even allow us to level off total greenhouse gas emissions for the planet.
Okay, so Schnorr there saying, Amy, that we have to push beyond the promises already made or being made in Paris at the moment.
Exactly. I mean, he was really dialed into just what it would take to reduce the warming. And there are goals about how many degrees of warming would be acceptable versus devastating. And, you know, as you heard, he's concerned that even with all the promises that were made in advance, that wouldn't be enough. So he's hoping out of these talks will come either increased pledges or other strategies for trying to prevent the average global temperature from getting even higher.
Mm-hmm. You also spoke with the director of the Center for Rural Affairs in Nebraska about, it's a word, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, miscanthus?
Miscanthus, right.
Yeah,
miscanthus.
Well, tell us about that.
Yeah, Jonathan Hladek is the policy director for the Center for Rural Affairs, and he was kind of raising his cup to celebrate farmers and the contributions they are already making toward diminishing greenhouse gas emissions. And one project he pointed to is both Iowa, University of Iowa and Iowa State are working together to develop this perennial grass as a feedstock for power generation.
Both Iowa State and the University of Iowa are working together to experiment with the use of miscanthus, which is a large perennial grass, to help offset the use of coal at on-campus generation facilities. This is a good example because the benefits are threefold. First, perennial grasses do a really good job of helping to restore soil and improve water quality. Second, using miscanthus to displace coal means less carbon pollution will enter the atmosphere. And finally, miscanthus is known to hold great potential for carbon sequestration. And that's the crux of the issue.
Okay, interesting there. Carbon sequestration. We don't hear, up to now, I haven't heard that much about it. And it's an important part of getting a grip on climate change, isn't it?
It really is critical. And there are certain regions of the world where more can be done, for example, in the polar regions in the Arctic that you hear a lot about carbon sequestration. Mm-hmm. But with farmland, because an individual property owner may own a significant parcel of land, the kinds of things that that property owner could do can potentially have more impact than what, say, a suburban homeowner might be able to do. It doesn't mean that all of us can't do our share, but it just means that farmers can be positioned in a way to do a little bit more. And Jonathan Hladek really celebrated farmers and said that they've been leading the way and have really been looking for outside-of-the-box contributions they can make to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Okay, Amy Mayer, IPR and Harvest Public Media reporter, telling us about how the Paris climate talks could bolster energy, alternative energy efforts here in the Midwest. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks, Ben.
Let's now turn to Grant Gerlach. Monday, the required renewable fuel standard level for 2016, the so-called RFS level, was announced. And this is the Obama administration's new requirement for the amount of ethanol that must be blended into the nation's gasoline. Grant Gerlach with us, Harvest Public Media reporter at NET News in Nebraska. Hi, Grant.
Great to be here.
Great to have you on the show. This is complicated, the level, when I read about this. I hope you can sort it out a little bit. What can you tell us about the new requirement? Because I know some groups are happy, others wish it would have gone farther.
Well, yeah, it's hard to find anyone who's actually satisfied with it, but I'll try to explain that. Now, for your listeners, remember this is the Renewable Fuel Standard. It was a law passed in 2005 and expanded in 2007. It's the law that says to oil companies you have to put ethanol and other biofuels into the gasoline supply, and this is how much. And Congress set up this schedule when they passed the law, but they also told the EPA it's your job each year to come up with the real mandate. So even though there is sort of this legal schedule, it's up to the EPA to determine year to year what the mandate is. So on Monday, they came out with the mandate for 2014, 2015, and 2016. And since 2014 is gone, 2015 is almost over, what people really wanted to see is what the EPA has in store for next year. And basically where they landed is less than the original RFS passed by Congress, but still more than they passed in May.
Okay. So when we talk about the support for ethanol, besides the farmers who produce the corn and the ethanol producers, is there any support or demand for it?
Well, there is, and the oil companies are okay with a certain amount of ethanol. It's actually, generally speaking, it's cheaper, although that's changed a bit because oil prices are so extremely low right now. But generally speaking, it's cheaper, and it helps them save money because of how they blend it into gasoline. So there's some support there. There's mixed support from environmental groups, depending on where they stand. Some groups really would like to see corn taken out of the equation in terms of producing ethanol. They don't believe it meets the standards that the government says it meets in terms of reducing greenhouse emissions. But, you know, for farmers, this really does mean a lot because they're sitting on this huge surplus of corn. They're looking at the lowest commodity prices in 5 or 6 years. Farm income is dwindling, although there's still some government support out there. But from their point of view, they're looking at anything that can take care of part of that oversupply to help rally corn prices. So that's why they wanted to see this number go up.
You can make this ethanol. We can make other crops into biofuels. Are those being tested? Where's the progress there?
Well, yeah, like you just talked about miscanthus. That's one of the potential crops, raising that, especially on ground that isn't so good for raising corn or other soybeans, things like that. Algae has been experimented with. Wood chips can be used. You can use a lot of different things. Generally speaking, it's the finances that have to be worked out. And in some cases, the technology needs to be perfected. But, you know, there in Iowa, you have two brand new plants using corn stalks to make advanced biofuels, which are beneficial because they cut greenhouse emissions even more than ethanol made from corn. So that's where the industry is headed. That's where the government wants the industry to go. But it's just been fits and starts because of the technology and getting the financial support for those technologies.
Mm-hmm. Grant, you know, most of us are not in this business, the ethanol business or the corn producing business. We have our connection to it at the gas pumps. Does this new level mean any change at the gas pumps, do you think?
For most people, no. Most people, if you aren't looking, if you aren't paying attention, you're probably putting fuel in your gas tank that's 10% ethanol. If you have a flex fuel vehicle, you can go up to the E85. And in places like Iowa and Nebraska, there are a lot of places, gas stations that have these blender pumps where you can choose the level that you want.
Mm-hmm.
In places where you might see a change are places where the ethanol industry wants to put more of those blender pumps. A lot of them are here in the Midwest, but there are places like California and Texas where they sell a number of flex fuel vehicles but haven't had the pumps there to sell the actual ethanol. So they're trying to get those pumps installed in those places to try to expand the amount of ethanol they sell.
Okay. Thank you very much for the update. Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media, reporter at NET News in Nebraska. Thanks, Grant.
You're welcome.
To finish off this half hour, you may know that we are experiencing what is called an El Nino year, and that's when there's the appearance of this unusually warm water in the Pacific Ocean that affects our weather. Well, the current Extreme Nino is now the strongest ever recorded, smashing a previous record from the late 90s. Whenever we talk about El Nino, I love to talk with Elwin Taylor, climatologist, ag meteorologist, and professor at Iowa State University. Elwin, another El Nino record? What does this mean?
Well, generally we consider the El Nino our friend here in the Midwest. And if a friend means having big crops and a winter that's not bitterly cold and a summer that's not oppressively hot, we're usually all for the El Nino, at least here. There's a different opinion if you're in the Northwest U.S. and adjacent Canada. There's different opinion if you lived in Australia. But we're kind of fond of it.
Mm-hmm. So does that have anything to do with the fact that I heard we had the warmest, wettest November ever?
That mostly had to do with El Nino, all right, but sort of around the back doorway, we had a couple of Pacific Ocean hurricanes come ashore in Mexico, and their moisture make it up toward us, and including the storms that we had this week, during this past week here in this part of the world. So, yes. Even El Nino had something to do with that.
Mm-hmm. So why would the El Nino become extreme? What is driving that? Is that a trend we can expect in the future, even greater El Ninos?
Maybe we could, but not necessarily. The El Nino is related to the warmth of the water along the equator in the Pacific Ocean, off the west coast of South America and out to the middle of the Pacific around the dateline. And, of course, when the wind quits and the sky is clear, then the sun heats the water. And when the water is heated 5 degrees warmer than usual, we have a good, strong El Nino. And they're judging the strength of this El Nino that you're hearing about by the temperature of the water that we have in that area. They're not judging it by the six factors that really go into making an El Nino's effect that reaches other places in the world. And it's actually number three in strength.
Okay,
if
so
we look at all of the factors.
Okay, there was a little bit of change in the way it was measured here to make it number one. So we have about a minute left, Elwin. So give us what this might mean for the coming months. You said Iowa, a more moderate winter, not the deep freeze that we're used to.
That's correct. And in the summer, it's not as hot as it could be when it's exceptionally hot. It just makes things closer to the average or to the normal. It's the La Nina that gives us extremes. El Nino is just closer to usual.
Mm-hmm. And in other parts of the country, quickly before we have to go, what does this weather pattern mean for the coasts?
For Southern California, moisture, Arizona moisture, all the way to Texas, and for the north, along the Canadian border with the U.S., drier than usual for the winter. For us, just a little milder, not as bitterly cold.
Excellent. Elwin Taylor, thank you for the update. A climatologist, a professor at Iowa State University. Thank you, Elwin.
Always good to be with you. I wish you the very best.
You too as well, Elwin. Talking about the current extreme El Nino, now the strongest ever recorded, but we just heard there that has partly to do with the measurement. When we come back, our News Buzz continues on this Friday. A study with some good news for the treatment of advanced breast cancer. And we hear about Vincent the Cat in Ames. You want to hear about this and watch the video we have online. A feline just fitted with an exceptional set of prosthetic limbs. That's when we come back. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a few minutes. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, really good news in the fight against breast cancer. It's a new study involving researchers at the University of Iowa Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center, published this week online in JAMA Surgery. It's a study that included more than 20,000 women with stage 4, that's advanced breast cancer, and finding that the survival has improved and is increasingly of prolonged duration, particularly for some women undergoing initial breast surgery. Here to tell us about it, one of the researchers involved, Dr. Alex Thomas, clinical professor in the University of Iowa Department of Internal Medicine, co-director of the Multidisciplinary Breast Oncology Group, Dr. Thomas, thanks for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me, Ben.
So what did you set out to do in this study?
Well, you know, a lot of the things I do research on are driven by what I see in the clinic. And I've been fortunate enough to have some women who have what, you know, when we see women today with stage 4 breast cancer, we have to tell them that we cannot cure this disease. We can try to find ways for you to live with it, but likely it will shorten your life. But increasingly, I'm seeing women who live for a long time. They actually go on and receive therapy, but live for years. In fact, I had one very dear patient whose daughter moved in with her because she thought mom wasn't going to live too long. The daughter since moved on to another city, gotten married, doing other things because mom's doing great. So that prompted us to ask the question, are women with stage 4, now many women unfortunately still succumb to the disease, but are there some who are living for a meaningful period, meaning years, and we chose 10 years. An interesting point we looked at, it's important to note that we found that women who had initial surgery for stage 4 breast cancer, about 10% lived 10 years or more. But those women had to have been diagnosed before 2002 because we needed 10 years of survival to have that information. So one thing we postulate is, what does that mean in 2015? We have better therapies, better imaging. Perhaps that's an even bigger group today than it was for those who were diagnosed in 2002. So we think this is a hopeful message. Does it mean everybody with stage 4 disease is going to do that well? But for a small and hopefully growing number of women, this is a possibility.
Does it have to do, this advance, have to do with specific treatment, specific therapies, or is it all of these things together are improving?
You got it exactly right. It has to do with a lot of things, in particular therapies. A lot of exciting therapies have come out in the last few decades. Targeted therapies come to mind immediately, the anti-HER2 therapies. Now we've got some targeted agents for hormone receptor positive disease, but also technology, some of the radiation therapy techniques. I have several patients who presented with advanced breast cancer a few years ago, looked like they had only one or two spots of distant disease in the bone, and my radiation oncology colleagues were able to do stereotactic radiotherapy, or they could tell you more about the technology, but with radiation ablate that site. Those patients seem to be doing really well.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us a sense, Dr. Thomas, where we all are overall in the treatment of breast cancer, as particularly this advanced breast cancer?
We are at an exciting point. A few years ago, we really didn't think that we could cure stage 4 breast cancer. And today, we still tell women that. But we are moving to an era where we can increasingly think, how can we get? And I use the word prolonged remission. Durable remission, meaning for a long time, we don't have evidence of the disease. But what I'm really trying to say is, I want to say cure, but I can't quite yet.
You could one day soon say cure?
You know what I've been telling people is that I'm old, but I'm not that old. And I think in my practicing lifetime, I will practice to tell women, you have stage 4 disease, and I'm hopeful that we can eradicate your disease. We are not there yet. I anticipate that we will get there.
Mm-hmm. I said good news at the beginning. This sounds like something more than good news.
I have a lot of faith in my breast oncology community that we've had significant advances and that we will have more and more advances to allow us to get there in the coming years.
Let me ask you about mammograms. There's been a lot of discussion about mammograms in the news lately, whether they're helpful or harmful, since I understand too many mammograms can result in perhaps an unnecessary surgery. What should we take away from the latest news about mammograms?
You know, those are great questions. Obviously, I have a bias because I have to see the patients whose cancers were missed between mammograms. So with that lens, and if you look at the latest guidelines, they did say that women can continue to have annual mammograms. It's really a choice for the individual patient based on their level of risk and how they're wired. Some women will worry about findings that are nothing. Some women will feel better having an annual exam or starting earlier. Because of my bias and because of what I have to see, I favor more early and more routine imaging. I'll be plain about that. And that is still included in the current guidelines.
One more thing I'd like to ask you about before we have to go. The study also found, I understand, disproportionately high numbers of African-American women among the women in this 20,000 women set were diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. What are the reasons that that would be?
You know, that is such an important, thank you for bringing that up. That is such an important point. That was highlighted, if you actually read the manuscript, there was an invited commentary. Lisa Newman, formerly of the University of Michigan, commented that we need to use all of our research to think about healthcare disparities. It probably is. I'm not an expert in this area, so I can only postulate, and there are others who've done much more deeper work on this, but probably multifactorial, including socioeconomic factors. And then, unfortunately, there African-American women do have a propensity to have a higher, some of the more aggressive breast cancers are disproportionately represented in that.
Is that
population.
Genetics, do we think? Or,
yeah. They
or
tend to have a higher incidence
or,
of triple-negative breast cancer. Mm-hmm. Some exciting work's been done at the University of Chicago suggesting that there's a genetic component, but we need to continue in all of our work to investigate how we can provide better care for all women with breast cancer and look at minority populations and also patients of different country of origin. There's a big push in oncology to really think globally about how we can care better for patients with cancer and not let living in a developing country be a handicap.
Okay. Fascinating and primarily good news. Dr. Alex Thomas, thank you for coming in today. Clinical professor in the University of Iowa Department of Internal Medicine, co-director of the Multidisciplinary Breast Oncology Group, talking about a new study she's involved in. Researchers at the University of Iowa Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center. If you'd like to find it, it's published this week online in JAMA Surgery. Dr. Thomas, thanks for coming in.
Great pleasure to be here with you today.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man.
Well, would you settle for a bionic kitty? News of another advance in medicine, this in veterinary medicine involving Vincent. Vincent is a 3-year-old domestic short-haired cat. And he now has something that only a couple dozen animals in the world have, a certain type of titanium alloy prosthetic hind legs. Dr. Mary Sarah Berg is with us. She's a veterinary orthopedic surgeon, director of the Canine Rehabilitation Center at Iowa State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. Joining us now, Dr. Berg, welcome. And you are the creator, actually the implanter of these legs. Before we get to those legs, tell us Vincent's story. I understand someone found a tiny kitten injured?
Yes, that's correct. It's great to be here talking with you this morning about Vincent because he's been a great patient of mine that I've known for about 3 years. He was brought into the Story County Animal Shelter in Iowa when he was just a couple weeks old, and it was obvious that he had a problem at that time. He was missing parts of his hind legs from almost just below the knee down on both sides. And obviously this presented a significant problem for him because he couldn't walk. You know, the legs were not functioning as they normally should. And as he grew, he started to develop sores in the bottoms of those kind of stumps that he was walking on.
Mm-hmm. So he wasn't born without legs. Something had injured him, had cut off his legs.
Well, I don't know exactly because we don't know his history before he was found. It's possible that something that happened before he was born, like an umbilical cord wrapped around his legs, or something could have amputated them shortly after birth. Unfortunately, that part will have to remain a mystery.
Mm-hmm. So tell us what you did then.
Well, when they first brought Vincent in to see me, I evaluated him, and really, he presented quite a complex problem because affecting both hind legs, simply amputating the bad leg and having him walk on 3 legs wasn't going to be an option. And so it was a pretty long process of determining what would be the best option to allow him to get some mobility and walk and run and do normal cat things. And that involved getting some specialized imaging through x-rays of the legs as well as CT scans to evaluate what bones were there and how big those bones were, and then to develop a plan for him. Mm-hmm. Initially, we tried some physical rehabilitation therapy to try to increase the motion in the joints, and even tried putting him in a little kitty or dog cart and see how he liked, you know, walking around in a wheelchair. And as you can probably imagine, cats don't really appreciate wheelchairs very much, so that wasn't a very successful option for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then Yeah, I contacted an implant company that I worked with before to try to develop something that would be unique for Vincent because he has such a unique problem. And what we ultimately did was design an implant that would be inserted into his femur bones, which are the thigh bones, and then traverse his skin, and then you can attach various leg attachments onto posts that come out of his skin. And it's a really kind of cutting-edge new technology in veterinary medicine, and it is sometimes used in humans as well for humans that have amputations from trauma or cancer. But again, it's not very well used in animals.
And if you'd like to see Vincent with his new prosthetic legs, we'll have a video on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. We'll also have a video on iowapublicradio.org, our website, with this post here. And I thought, oh, I don't know if I want to see a kitty with prosthetic legs. But you look at it, Vincent looks very happy with these legs, doesn't he?
He does, and he is really doing extremely well at this point. Some people might notice that his legs seem kind of short, and they are. We started with legs even shorter than what you see in that video and are working our way into longer and longer legs. But when those don't require additional surgery to change, we can just essentially unscrew them, slide them off the posts, and then slide new ones on.
Mm-hmm.
And so the goal will be to get him even longer legs so he walks with his back, you know, kind of more horizontal to the ground like a normal cat would walk.
I guess the question would be also, how soon might Vincent be jumping onto counters to find some unattended cheese or sausage?
I think he'll be doing that really soon.
Really?
The video that you have, he had just gotten those legs that were a little bit longer, and he almost wants to jump up on things right now. And so it could be, you know, a week, it could be a month. It might be until we get a little bit longer leg on him. I think we'll just have to wait and see. But right now, he's really showing like he wants to do it, so I think it could be any day now.
What does this mean for other animals, dogs, for instance, or possibly even for humans? Is this something we can learn from, build on for not just cats?
Yes, absolutely. There is a lot to learn, you know, within cats, dogs, and humans. And in some cases, people have used technology like this in animals as a model for trying to develop new technologies for humans because they face similar problems. And one of the big problems that animals and humans have with this type of technology is infection. Because we have an implant that's within the bone and also exposed to the external world, you don't always have a great barrier to keep all the normal bacteria out of the bone. And so when that happens, you can have infection, which can be painful, and may also cause loosening of the implant and rejection of the implant. And so using kind of similar technologies and also new technologies, we try to get a better seal around from the skin and soft tissues around the implant that's exposed to the external environment.
Mm-hmm. How is that solved in Vincent's case?
Well, in Vincent's case, we tried to attack that potential problem with some of our implant designs. And we had special coating and surface on the implants to help the skin and soft tissues adhere to it. And also our surgical technique was designed to maximize the soft tissues around the bone itself so we can help get as good of a seal as possible around both the bone and the implant. That said, he's certainly not out of the woods for infection, and we take special care. We spray a silver antimicrobial spray along the post to hopefully decrease the chance of getting an infection in that area.
Do you foresee one day that cats who get into accidents, just like people do, and lose limbs, it'll be ordinary or fairly ordinary to go to the veterinarian to get a prosthetic leg for your dog or your cat?
Well, I think we're probably a long way off from that. And the first choice is always to try to save the leg whenever possible because the body's natural limbs are always going to be the best. But I think it's important that people see that there are options for cases where, like Vincent, where saving the leg, the whole leg, is an option either because it's there or maybe it's had a traumatic amputation. And so I think one of the best things about this case is getting people to realize that they do have options for pets like this.
Okay. Dr. Mary Sarah Berg,
veterinary orthopedic surgeon at Iowa State University. Thanks for telling us about Vincent and the promise that his case holds. If you'd like to see Vincent in action with his prosthetic, his titanium alloy prosthetic hind legs, go to iowapublicradio.org or go to our Facebook page. Dr. Mary Sarah Berg, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And we're coming to the end of this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining me now, Jacqueline Hallbloom, IPR classical music host and host of IPR's monthly Iowa Arts Showcase, which airs tomorrow, Saturday, December 5th at 11 in the morning, also at 5 p.m. in the evening on Iowa Public Radio Classical. Hello, Jacqueline.
Hey, Ben.
You are going to ring in the holidays this month on the showcase, aren't you?
So many cool things happening this month, and those people that say there's nothing to do in Iowa are totally wrong. There's so many.
Yeah, there is a lot. I'm looking at the rundown here.
Yes, and I must say that with all this rushing around, going to a concert and just sitting back and enjoying it is a great way to enjoy the holidays.
Yeah. So let's take a little tour of the state with the arts you have on the program this week. Let's go to Cedar Rapids first. How about that?
In January, they are going to be doing Verdi's masterpiece La Traviata, and James Marvel is their guest stage director, and he took a little bit of time to give us some background about La Traviata, and he's just an amazing stage director, and we're really lucky to have him coming to the state, so it's going to be a wonderful production.
Okay, this is at the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater. James Marvel providing a version, a glimpse into Verdi's masterpiece La Traviata. That's at the Paramount Theater in
right.
downtown Cedar
and that's
Rapids.
Going to be in January for performances of that. But the singers are coming later this month to start working things out and putting it all together.
Where else you want to take us, Jacqueline?
Well, I'd love to go to the Heartland Marimba Festival Ensemble's Holiday Spectacular Winter Concert Tour.
Mm.
These guys, there's three of them. They're on the road with marimbas, and they also have a glass xylophone, which is a really unusual instrument, and they're doing a lot of wonderful holiday tunes, but they're also playing on marimbas. It's not your usual average bear kind of music, so a great way to enjoy the holidays and hear some fun tunes as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and what would the holidays be without a great rendition of the Nutcracker Ballet?
I'm so glad you said that, because Iowa State Center this year, they are celebrating their 35th anniversary of performances of Tchaikovsky's The Nutcracker Ballet. And we were so lucky on the Iowa Art Showcase to talk to three of the people who were there.
Really?
And helped start this whole thing, and they have stuck with it. And it's just an amazing how this has grown and become something that it is now, that it's a regular tradition in Ames. And Joy Volker, who's going to be dancing the Sugar Plum Fairy, was originally a Clara. So, and a lot of these dancers go on to be professional dancers. So it's really a very high-quality performance, and it's amazing. And hats off to Iowa State Center and to these folks for doing the Nutcracker for 35 years and selling out the house.
Right. A wonderful holiday event, I understand, up in Cedar Falls, also up at the Gallagher Blue Dorm Performing Arts Center.
Bill Shepherd is pulling out all of his holiday stops for his big band Christmas concert, and he's bringing his daughter back, Nola Shepherd, who went to UNI for a little bit but then ended up going to Berkeley in Boston to get a songwriter-singer degree, and she's got a fabulous voice. She's going to be actually performing one of the pieces that she's written, a holiday piece, but this band has practically the whole UNI music faculty in it. It's so tight, so good, so fantastic, and they're going to be rolling out the dance floor for this, too. So many great tunes, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
Okay, and in fact, you talked that up so much, we can't help but have a little listen to Nola Shepherd and her dad. Here's just a little sample of what you may get when you go to this event at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center. A little bit of a Jingle Bell Rock.
Jingle Bell time, dancing and prancing in Jingle Bell Square. In the frosty air, what a bright time, it's the right time to rock the night away. Jingle bell time.
And finally, with a minute or two we have left, Jacqueline, the Texas Tenors coming to Des Moines.
It's amazing. They're going to be appearing with the Des Moines Symphony on New Year's Eve at the Civic Center of Greater Des Moines. And, of course, the Texas Tenors have a couple of Iowa connections, John Hagen from Waverly, and also Marcus Collins is from Southeast Iowa. And they are going to be doing some terrific music with the symphony. And plus, I mean, this is like Hollywood and Las Vegas hits the Civic Center because they have the lights, they have the smoke, they have it all. And plus, they sing so well together. And it's just going to be a wonderful way to polish off the year.
Okay, let's go out this hour with a little bit of the Texas Tenors featuring John Hagen of Waverly. John, the brother of Nancy Hagen, our colleague, Jacqueline, in the development staff here at IPR. Let's go out. What are we going to hear?
Thank God I'm a country boy.
Okay, Jacqueline Hallbloom, Iowa Public Radio classical music host, also host of the monthly Iowa Arts Showcase. Catch it tomorrow, Saturday, 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. Thanks, Jacqueline.
Thank you so much, Ben, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you.
Well, a simple kind of life never did me no harm. Raising me a family and a working on the farm. My days are all filled with an easy country charm. I thank God I'm a country boy. Well, I got me a fine wife, I got me a fiddle. When the sun's coming up, I got cakes on the grill. Life ain't nothing but a funny, funny riddle. I thank God I'm a country boy. Well, the work's all done and the sunset low. I pull out my fiddle and I rosin up the bow. The kids are all asleep, so I keep it kind of low.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.